Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew.
Rough night.
It was. I just had hopped on Michigan basketball's bandwagon. I'm a huge Michigan football fan. I hopped on the bandwagon just long enough to watch a bruising, ego-crushing, confidence-deflating, buzzer-beating loss to the Oregon Ducks. And now I'm trying to rally for this NBA podcast.
Good. Yes, we've got NBA questions that are going to take you out of your depression here. I was watching, wondering whether your Michigan fandom extended to basketball. I fell in love with Derek Walton, so I totally sympathize with where you are right now. But let's talk NBA. You know, let's turn over a whole new leaf for you.
I love this because I got all these angry DMs and I know they were trying to avoid you. I love our listeners. They're pretty smart because they know that you secretly love college basketball and you want to talk college basketball. But there's a lot of hardcore NBA fans out there who don't want to hear the NCAA talk. I mean, they might want to hear some prospect talk, and we're going to get into that on this podcast. But they want me to pull you back from the abyss to have some great NBA analysis and arguments. And that's what we're here to do, because we got some unbelievable questions this week. I say that every week, so it sounds like I'm lying and pandering and trying to sell Mack Weldon sweats. Not true. We got some awesome questions this week.
Yeah, it really is cool how you guys consistently send good questions. So we appreciate it. And I've noticed some of the same forum shopping. Like, if someone's hating on you, they'll come to me. And if someone's hating on me, they'll go to you. So keep it up. We notice.
Yeah, they're expecting us to get divorced. So they're like the kids who are angling for the settlements. I'm on to you guys.
All right. Well, let's jump in with Barack, longtime listener, who minutes after the pod was posted last week said, after today's Westbrook convo, you had to see this question coming. Who's your top five to start a franchise? So on I think it was Tuesday's pod, I mentioned that I sort of amended a Westbrook hot take to say that he's great, but he would not be in my personal top five to start a franchise with. But Ben, you go first with your top five.
Yeah, here's the bad news. So I said he was going to be in the bottom part of my top five, but when I really sat down to do it, I'm not even sure he's in my top five. So now we're just going to anger these Westbrook fans even more, which is not my intention. But here, try to talk me out of this. I think number one's got to be LeBron. Period.
Yes.
I'm not sure there's any conversation. Number two, when fully healthy, I think the answer is Kevin Durant. In terms of two-way impact, all-around skills, ability to carry an offense, track record of winning, mismatch ability every time he's on the court, can play multiple positions.
Can I ask you a question, though? What is the time frame we're working with here? Are we talking about top five to start a franchise with to win, like, this year or the next 3 years or what?
So here's how I did it, Andrew. I made one list for just this upcoming season, and then I made another list of under 25 guys, because honestly, like, I'm so much about having the bird in hand that even if you told me this is for like the next 3, 4, or 5 years, I'd still pick the same guys. I'd still pick LeBron. I'd still pick Durant as number two.
I figured that's perfect.
So after Durant, I went to Steph. That's where it starts to get close, because I think you can make an argument for Kawhi, but I think you're just guaranteed an elite offense with Steph shooting. Very clear role definition, his ability to make average players look a lot better than average because of how much attention he draws. I think you can't undersell that. Number four, I had Kawhi. Number five, I was doing this same conversation we had at the start of the season with Rob Mahoney during the top 100. We were trying to parse between Harden, Westbrook, and Chris Paul. At the start of the season, we picked Chris Paul. I mean, you could probably ding him a little bit for his injuries and his age. I think based on how the season's played out, I'd put Harden into that number five spot, with Westbrook just barely behind him at number six, dropping Chris to seven. But you can't go wrong with any of those three guys. That's my list. Where do you nitpick?
My list is about the same. I would also throw, basically, Harden is my fifth guy, the same top four. I would also throw Jimmy Butler and maybe Giannis into the mix. I mean, Giannis has been really, really good. We're about to talk Bucks, and we'll talk Bucks in like 20 minutes, but like, Giannis is almost at that level, but I think Russ is probably six or seven, depending on how you rank him with Jimmy Butler.
And then you got to go Millsap, right?
Totally. You know me. You know me so well.
Now that you're 30 years old, you got to go Millsap. No, I'm kidding. A couple other guys to consider in this top 10. I think you got to, at least for this upcoming season, Kyle Lowry, John Wall. I think, you know, that's starting to, and you already had Butler and Paul George probably should be in there too. I think that's kind of what your top 10 is looking like if you have to start from scratch. I mean, the key defining quality I'm looking for is making their teammates better. You know, that's definitely something I'm really prioritizing in this conversation. That's why LeBron would be one. That's probably why I'd give, you know, Harden an edge over some of these other guys, is just his ability to really genuinely playmake, but also just all around skill level too. I mean, that's why you can't overlook Kawhi. I mean, this is really an impossible question. I'm not sure if you can ever even come close to making people happy with these choices.
Well, who, real quick, who's on your 25 and under?
Giannis, number one. Towns, number two. Actually, I think a healthy Joel Embiid would be number two, but I can't even put him on my top five at this point, given that he's going under the knife again.
Yeah.
I know, it's rough, right? Towns, number two. Anthony Davis, three. And then I think, you know, the four and five spots, you know, kind of flip a coin between Jokic, Porzingis, and Gobert. What's really weird about this under 25 top group right now is that it's so bigs dominated. And I actually think that's why you got to give Giannis the number one spot, because he's kind of shaping up to be like in this class by himself in terms of his age group when it comes to, you know, wing players, dominant two-way wing players and ball handlers. The gap between him and other guys at his age is pretty substantial.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The stuff that he's been able to do this year, there's not a lot of talent in Milwaukee, and he's got them. I mean, Middleton is back, but Giannis has been at a pretty high level, and he's still only 22 years old, which is insane. So, I'm glad that you chose Towns number two, because I think he's supplanted Anthony Davis for me, only because of the injury questions. But Brow and Towns are right there. But let's move on here. Danny, also following up on the Russ discussion, the Russ and KD discussion, he said, when do we talk about Harden throwing all of last season? It only seems fair. Hashtag Team Golliver. So
didn't we talk about that extensively? Like, weren't we spending like a solid 4 or 5 months just killing Harden last year?
Oh, absolutely. We talked about it last year, but I feel like he's talking about within the context of the MVP debate, because I was saying that the way Russ played a role in Durant leaving. I don't know. I don't think it's fair to hold Harden's last season against him this year, but we should never, ever forget how atrocious last year's Rockets were. Like, I saw some people on Twitter complaining that James Harden didn't make all NBA last year, and maybe like numbers wise he had a good case, but listen, that was one of the most miserable basketball teams I think the NBA has ever seen, and it was just the nightly spectacle. And I like, if anything, we didn't make enough of it at the time.
Yeah, and we made a lot of it at the time. Here's kind of how I would thread this needle. He's got a point, you know, like Harden is maybe getting a little bit too much credit for the turnaround aspect of his story. Like, we shouldn't just be saying, oh, it's amazing that he finally pulled himself together, into the season in shape, and isn't in this ego battle with Dwight Howard, because all those aspects of the turnaround story, you know, kind of indirectly reference some pretty serious character flaws, including his lack of leadership last year. But I don't think that last year should be the defining mechanism for judging his season this year, right? Let's just try to judge what he's doing on the court and how he's carrying his team and what progress he's made. Now, one thing I do actually give credit for to Harden is his acknowledgement of some of his limitations. And I know you think I'm drinking the Harden Kool-Aid because of that one-on-one interview I did with him in December, but he came back with a different perspective. I think you could see that in Lee Jenkins' story as well, a different focus. I don't think that that should be, again, the number one reason why we're voting for him. Let's not overstate his turnaround, but let's give him credit for the progress he's made and the accountability that he's had for his own weaknesses.
Yeah. No, that's totally fair. Last year was just a historic achievement in apathy. And that that should maybe factor in your point about, I think we are giving him a lot of credit in the turnaround, and that is, I don't know how much that should factor into it. But more importantly, can we talk about Thunder Rockets on Sunday? Because I feel like that's gonna, like, that could really go a long way toward deciding the MVP race.
Yeah, I really feel like we've had a series of those games, though, haven't we? Like, isn't every new game that's come up now become like the decision point for the MVP? Like, I was jokingly saying the other night, oh, you know, Steph kills Russ. Does that take him out of the MVP conversation? And a week before that, it was the Spurs versus Harden. You know, Kawhi locks down Harden late, so therefore he's the MVP. I think we're getting into a little bit too much of this night-to-night over-analysis. But certainly, it's a strong opportunity for Harden to solidify his lead. I mean, would you agree he's going into that game in the lead?
I don't know. It sort of feels like Russ is coming on a little bit. We've talked about it plenty, but it definitely, like, I think it's those two guys and everybody else for a variety of reasons. And for me, it just seems like we've hit a lull in the season where a lot of the teams are kind of just going through the motions. But that will be a hell of a game on Sunday.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. We got a bunch of Bucks questions. I don't know if you noticed that or if you're just trying to be polite by actually talking about something else before the Bucks questions, but are you about to unload like six Milwaukee questions on us?
Yeah, all right. So we had a couple Bucks questions from a few weeks ago. The first was from Jackson, who said, huge Giannis fan. However, I feel like people making him a lock for all NBA are overlooking the team struggles. Can you guys discuss? The other one was from someone called Shishi Kishi, who said, we need Bucks hot takes. Should they fire Kidd? Is Jabari good? What's the value of his contract extension? Is Thon the GOAT to be? So that was 2 weeks ago. That's about where the Bucks season was. It's like trying to talk yourself into Thon Maker as the future savior and wondering whether they should fire Jason Kidd. And now we got two questions from Sean Drought, who actually sent us a bunch of good stuff. First, how worried is Sharp that the Wizards might end up drawing the Bucks in the first round? Second, should Bucks fans be excited about a future big three of Giannis, Middleton, and Jabari, assuming he can come back healthy? Or should they consider it a bit of a red flag that the recent hot streak has come without Jabari and his defense? So, number one, I am worried about anyone that the Wizards could draw in the first round because it would be really embarrassing after some of the hype this year in DC to come out and fall flat on their face in the first round. But, and I mean, basically I'm praying for a matchup with the Pacers. The Bucks are scary. The Heat are scary. But Milwaukee specifically, I don't know, like, what do you see from them right now?
Well, it's funny how much changed in 2 weeks, right? Like, let's fire the coach to like, oh my God, they're going to play spoiler in the first round again. That's kind of been the story. I mean, they had an awesome road trip recently. I don't know if you saw their game against the Blazers in Portland. That, to me, was kind of a shocking result. And, you know, Giannis had an unbelievable kind of game-winning defensive play down the stretch. They've just kind of righted the ship. You know, I'm a big Middleton guy. You know, people, that's, you know, a real surprise. I'm sure people are you know, accusing me of self-parody for loving Middleton. But to me, their turnaround is more about adding Middleton back to the mix as opposed to taking Jabari out of the mix. If I'm correct, they never played a single minute together the whole season, like their top three guys, Middleton, Giannis, and Jabari, because the way the injuries overlapped. I guess my concern going forward is I'm kind of skeptical about what Jabari is going to be at this point based on his injuries. I look at their core, to me, it's Giannis and Middleton basically at this point. But I still see a lot of untapped potential for Giannis. Even though he's made this gigantic progress, I think he's kind of on track to be the king of the East after LeBron. You know, I think he's pretty clearly in that leading pole spot. And I really want them to have the most favorable first round matchup possible because I want him to have as many postseason reps as possible. And I don't think Washington's the only team that's afraid of seeing them. Now, if I'm the Raptors, I'm a little bit nervous about Giannis and the Bucks in the first round. Like, if you're the Raptors, wouldn't you rather play the Hawks than the Bucks?
Yeah. I mean, the Hawks have looked pretty awful over the last few weeks. And granted, like, Bazemore's hurt. They've been banged up a little bit, but And you don't want to read too much into March because I think a lot of these teams are just exhausted. But the Hawks are not really scaring anybody, and are probably not as good as their record suggests. Whereas like the Bucks, playoff Giannis, who knows? Like we're sort of just scratching the surface with all this. To answer the one question on the Jabari thing is really interesting. It's such a bummer that we never got to see him healthy alongside Middleton because it's kind of hard to grade their future without seeing how that looks because Middleton's defense is really important to them as well. So having said that, like Jabari went from sort of like icing on the cake with the whole Giannis progression to now it's kind of like, it's scary to think about giving him $130 million with like the knee, a total question mark.
Yeah, I don't see it. I think that they're going to have to slow play that one and kind of make him, first of all, make him get back on the court and show that he can be an impact player again after the multiple knee injuries. And I think he's just going to have to understand that. You know, I'm not sure there's any way around it based on the severity of those injuries. Isn't it kind of interesting, though? I'm not sure it's funny because it's not funny. But like Minnesota taking off without LaVine and Milwaukee taking off without Jabari here a little bit down the stretch. Do you see parallels there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're two guys who score a lot of points and don't really do a whole lot more. I think Jabari was valuable in Milwaukee because he was an option that they could go to at the end of games. And that really sort of, that was something that they needed because Giannis, the one area where he's not great is sort of creating offense for himself in the half court. And Jabari could do that. But now Middleton's doing that. And if you can basically get that same contribution with a guy who's a plus defender, then obviously that's a win. And I think in Minnesota, it's similar. Like they're getting some of those empty buckets from Shabazz Muhammad, and that's working out just fine.
So let me put it to you this way. Let's flip this around because you were looking at it from the Washington perspective. If you're a Bucks fan, and we know you are, who do you want them to face in the first round that gives them the best chance to advance? I mean, obviously, you know, everything from like the fifth seed to the eighth seeds in play for them. I mean, it's so tight at this point. Who do you think they have the best chance of beating?
Probably, I don't want to pick the Wizards, but I think I would want to play the Wizards if I were the Bucks, because the Wizards, there's a chance that the Wizards are just out of gas and that the starting five has played way too many minutes. Gortat and Markieff Morris just haven't looked the same since the All-Star break. And if those guys are not going to sort of snap out of it, then they are going to be vulnerable. And like, whereas I think the Raptors, by the time we get to the playoffs, and if Kyle Lowry's healthy, I think they would be a lot tougher to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, that's the sneaky team you probably don't want to play. I mean, Miami's gotten a lot of attention as like the team you don't want to play in the first round, and we've talked about that before. I'm still not totally sold on their upset potential. But if we go back to like January, you know, I was pretty convinced Milwaukee was going to win a playoff series. Of those bottom four teams, Atlanta, Milwaukee, Indiana, Miami, to me, the Bucks have the best shot at doing it. In terms of who against, I could see potentially, you know, Toronto, if they're trying to reintegrate Lowry and it's just kind of funky and he's off and, you know, maybe they start to feel the pressure a little bit. I could see some, you know, possible upset potential there. I actually think the top three seeds at this point would be okay against Milwaukee. So I guess what I'm rooting for is Bucks in the five seed to really push the Raptors in the first round.
You know what's most important, though, is that as of right now, we're not going to have to watch the Chicago Bulls in the NBA playoffs. And that is a real victory for basketball fans everywhere.
Yeah, they don't want to be in there. I mean, the Bulls and the Pistons are right there at the top of the list of teams who are like, nah, we're good. You know, like everyone's arguing about this whole like rest scenario of like, oh, no, like LeBron's got to take a night off. Like the Bulls and the Pistons are like, yeah, I think we should just rest through all of May and June.
I think, did the Pistons lose to the Nets this week?
They did on a buzzer beater. Brooke Lopez buzzer beatered, right? But they also just got smoked by the Bulls, and that's not easy right now.
Yeah, well, tough year. Let's move on. I've really been looking forward to this the entire podcast, this question. JW Cox asks, this Baxter Holmes story deserves some open floor discussion. Golliver, when's the last time you ate PB&J? Sharp, strawberry jelly or grape? So I pulled some excerpts from Baxter Holmes' story. Real quick, did you know about the NBA's peanut butter and jelly addiction?
I have seen the big tubs of peanut butter, like the really large, like sketchily large tubs of peanut butter with like stacks of bread around various locker rooms before. I didn't know it went quite as deep. I'm not sure anybody knew it went quite as deep until Baxter did this, like, you know, 15,000 word opus on it, because there was some serious heavy lifting on the research. Like, he was cornering Adam Silver after a panel to like grill so him good. About his choice of jelly. I mean, he went all out on this one.
Yeah, seriously. Shout out to Baxter Holmes. This was probably my favorite NBA story of the year. I had never made the connection with the peanut butter and jelly before. I mean, I've seen them in locker rooms, and honestly, like, I've never been tempted to take any sort of gear or anything that's laying around. But sometimes you'll walk through a post-game locker room and there's just like all this fresh food just sitting there going untouched. And I'm tempted to turn into the Tom Brady jersey thief and just grab some of the peanut butter and jelly. And then they also have like gourmet food too. And it's, I don't know, I'm not going to cross that line, but I've been tempted.
Yeah, this is reminding me of All-Star. We were standing around waiting for LeBron for like 45 minutes. So Chris Haynes grabbed a Gatorade out of one of the players' Gatorade jugs.
Exactly. And there's endless Gatorade.
So as soon as he grabs it, like seven other reporters are like, well, the seal's broken. I'm going to go grab a Gatorade, right? And then we just hear this like stampede of footsteps. And I was completely convinced they were going to throw all these guys out of here for stealing the Gatorade. But yeah. It wasn't actually security. It was just a bunch of other writers wanting to steal the free Gatorade. So just... the moral of this story is, if you ever do grab one of the PB&Js, expect every other reporter in the room to get your back. I mean, it's going to be a gravy train.
Yeah, I think it's a line you don't cross, but the bread always looks so fresh. It's just the PB&J game is impeccable across the league. So
stop dodging the tough hitting questions, though. Strawberry jelly or grape?
I'm not really that discerning when it comes to jelly. I mean, I think if I were in a store, I'm generally a grape guy, but I don't really care.
Oh my God, you're a terrorist.
Well, apparently Adam Silver feels the same way.
Okay, well, I don't know. I think less of you.
All right, well, here, hold on. Let's read a couple excerpts from the story. The Bucks might boast the NBA's most elaborate PB&J operation, a pregame buffet featuring smooth, crunchy, and almond butters. An assortment of jellies, raspberry, strawberry, grape, blueberry, apricot, three breads from a local bakery, white, wheat, and gluten-free, and Nutella. The team scarfs 20 to 30 PB&Js per game and travels with the ingredients, which rookies prepare on the plane and in visiting locker rooms. So if I were on the Bucks, I wouldn't want rookies preparing my peanut butter and jelly. I feel like there are team employees who could probably do a better job than like Thonmaker.
Well, my favorite part of the story was the team employees who were like bitching about having to do it. You know, it was just like the Celtics guys started this trend. So all of a sudden they're the ones who like get saddled with this duty. That would get really old. If you had to fix 24 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches before every game, that would be awful.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And every team does it. The Rockets, they have PB&J available in their kitchen at all times with a variety of breads. Kevin Durant is such a fan that he worked with Nike to unveil a PB&J colored sneaker. Oh yeah, I included this note because those were the ugliest sneakers I've ever seen.
Those were terrible. I'm glad you said that, because I was going to say the same thing. I usually love KD's sneakers, and they're pretty creative with like the special colorways. Like, he's always like shouting out his Aunt Pearl, and you know, he's got these MLK Day versions and all this. The peanut butter and jelly was like a one-hit wonder that just flopped.
Yeah, just awful. Russell Westbrook prefers Skippy and strawberry jelly between toasted wheat bread. It's halved sometimes, depending on his move, with butter slathered on the inside. I don't know about the butter along with peanut butter and jelly, but do your thing, Russ. What's your PB&J experience?
Okay, so I've been told that I should not share this publicly, so this is like a tough way to start this story, but I'm not like a big peanut butter and jelly guy, but when I was a kid, probably like 76 to 78% of the calories that I in Took was peanut butter, just like on everything. So when I was a kid, and if you're eating dinner or like eating lunch, anyone, like, just consider stop eating or like just fast forwarding through this. So what we would do is like we would make tacos, like your normal like beef Ortega tacos, like, you know, at home tacos.
Sure.
And we would then make them double decker tacos, but instead of using like cheese to put the soft shell together with the hard shell, I would just like use like a layer of peanut butter. So we would actually make peanut butter tacos. That was like my delicacy. And somehow, because I have a little brother who was just do whatever that I was doing, kind of like a tag along type little brother, he got pulled into this and he thought it was normal. So for like almost our entire childhood, that was like our delicacy meal. And if you served me one right now, I don't eat beef anymore, but like if you serve me a double decker veggie taco with peanut butter in between the two shells, I would eat it 100%.
That is horrifying. So wait, you're eating taco meat, and were there cheese on the tacos?
No, it's a completely normal taco. Like you got the beef, you got the cheese, you got the lettuce, you got the tomato. Sometimes I put a little ranch on top, you know, make it a little zesty Southwest taco.
Oh my
taco.
God, ranch and peanut butter.
But then there'd be a thick layer of peanut butter connecting the two shells.
Yeah, well, that's horrifying, man. I'm glad you've moved on.
Also, like I would heat up the soft shell, obviously. So like the peanut butter would turn into almost like this liquidy version of peanut butter. But no, I'm serious. Like I'd eat it again right now and I'd enjoy it.
Well, so let me ask you, did Baxter's story make you have a relapse?
No, it hasn't. Primarily because like I don't eat tacos that much anymore. Well, number one, I had to boycott Chipotle because I was going to Chipotle all the time before their whole scandal. So then that really kind of turned me off to Chipotle in general, but also like sort of Mexican food more generally. But then it's just tougher to order tacos when you don't have the meat part of it. It's like one of the worst parts about being a vegetarian, because obviously like chicken and beef are like integral to the taco, and it's just, it feels fake if you don't have it. So I haven't relapsed back to that, but if you served it to me, I would definitely eat it, and I would like encourage you to eat it as well.
Okay. Well, thank you to Baxter Holmes. I've gone through a hardcore peanut butter and jelly sandwich phase over the last 72 hours since reading that story. So I'm back in. I'm eating enough peanut butter and jelly for the both of us.
How much would I have to pay you to try one of my tacos?
Nah, man, I'm off the list. I stayed loyal to Chipotle through the scandal though, so I'm not that discerning, but ranch, cheese, and peanut butter is a bridge too far for me.
I love how you'll take food poisoning over my delicacy. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I will. One more thing while we're talking food. Can you tell the people about your Benegrino?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's just my secret recipe. You guys, have you ever heard of a soda stream? Like, have you ever used one?
I bought a soda stream and was really into it for about 90 days, like 3 years ago.
I'm obsessed with it. So I'm making my own, like, you know, basically Perrier or Pellegrino at home. I just like to call it Benegrino. It adds a little classy flavor, like personalized flavor. I mean, sure, it's a little bit like the Ben version of a Big Baller brand, you know? Like, I'm kind of naming it after myself. I realize that's a little corny. But you just throw a little lemon seasoning in there. You got yourself a nice drink.
Yeah. Well, for people who don't realize what we're talking about, basically, we're going to record the podcast on Tuesday. And Ben says, yeah, just give me a second. I'm making a Benegrino. And come back 5 minutes later, and I was like, what is a Benegrino? I thought it was like maybe some sort of delicacy, but nah. Or maybe like, I actually thought it was like a microwavable meal, but Benegrino, perfect.
Look, if you're trying to wash down a peanut butter taco, nothing is better than homemade sparkling lemon water. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay, well, we've gotten way off course here, but let's get back to hoops. Ben Ladner asks, Avery Bradley is clearly an awesome player and a first or second team all Golliver player. Why are the advanced numbers so unkind to him? Is it just because he's undersized for his position, or is there something I'm missing? Help me figure this out.
Yeah, he really isn't loved by the advanced numbers, and people have been doing this digging for a while. I think the undersized thing definitely plays part of it. I mean, he's always going to have disadvantages in terms of his individual matchups. You know, having Isaiah on the court doesn't really do him any favors. I think, you know, overall their defensive personnel sort of behind him He's never going to be a big-time rebounder, you know, so that's probably going to work against him. In terms of the on-off numbers, you know, if he's playing with this big-time, like, rim protector, you know, if he was playing with Gobert behind him, I think you'd see a big bump in his defensive numbers as well. But, you know, offensively, like, his assist-to-turnover ratio is not good. You know, he's not a playmaker for others. He's pretty much solely a complimentary scorer. So that's going to kind of sink his player efficiency rating. But he's one of those guys where trust the eye test, right? Like, if this guy's making every single elite point guard completely flummoxed and frustrated because of how hard he hawks the ball, go with that. You know, sometimes it's okay to put aside the DRPM numbers or the defensive ratings and just say, look, this guy can get after it. And certainly he can do that. It's also just really hard to play his style of defense when you're going through tons and tons of screens, you're exerting a lot of energy over the course of an 82 game season, and ask yourself, like, who besides Avery Bradley would you want in a 7-game series as a perimeter defender? You know, I mean, maybe Patrick Beverley, a couple other guys would be in the conversation, but there's not that many people you'd take over Avery Bradley. So I guess my takeaway here is trust the eye test.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, and someone brought it up a couple mailbags ago. I mean, he is actually, like, really, really important to what they're doing. And I think that with the numbers stuff, I think as a general rule, numbers just don't account for defense very well at all. I mean, like, there is a whole subculture of the basketball internet over, like, not so much now, but in, like, December and January, that were obsessing over like Kawhi's plus minus relative to the Spurs and the way his defense was reflected in the numbers. And, like, I think you just can't really pay that much attention to those, because there are also guys who grade out better than they actually are. Like, I think some of Steph's numbers defensive RPM were pretty misleading last year. Like, he's not an awful defender. He's not like Isaiah Thomas, Westbrook level, but he's also not as good as the numbers sometimes make him look.
Yeah, I mean, Boston's been healthy and their team defensive numbers have been a lot better because they're playing a lot more lineups that have 4 quality defenders or 5 quality defenders on the court simultaneously. And that's one thing to keep in mind when it comes to, like, defensive stats is, you know, it takes one weak link to really screw everything, you know, pretty badly on that end. And, you know, he's playing with one of the weakest links defensively in the entire league, and, you know, a fair number of minutes with that guy. So,
yeah, that's actually a good point.
You know, with Avery, like, just try to picture a scenario where Danny Ainge actually traded him, you know, based on his contract number, based on all the things that he does and how well he fits with their guys. The asking price for Avery Bradley would be absolutely through the roof. And that's not just a Danny Ainge thing, by the way. Like, just picture any GM with their roster, you know, what's the price to really peel an Avery Bradley away? It would be monstrous.
Yeah, someone, I forget who I was reading. I think it might have been Kevin O'Connor was writing about D'Angelo Russell and was saying that Avery Bradley is crucial to Isaiah Thomas the same way that Patrick Beverley is to James Harden. And you can't really name, like, that's kind of the list as far as guards who can play both ways and make up for guys with, like, egregious defensive shortcomings. Like, you can't name many more players that you can start and have them be good enough to, like, compensate for someone like D'Angelo Russell's defense.
I mean, the other thing, though, is, you know, sometimes the undersized thing will come back to bite you, you know, and we've seen that before. Like, you know, he's not a perfect defensive player. Like, if he gets stuck in a situation where he has to guard an elite wing, you know, he's going to really struggle. I mean, he's going to get pounded. You know, he's going to have to find himself fouling in certain situations. So, you know, he's always going to be best in a scenario where he can guard the other team's point guard, you know, or other team's smaller guard, combo guard. And people love to celebrate the undersized guys, you know, whether it's Isaiah Thomas or Avery Bradley, and kind of hype them up because, you know, they're pound for pound, you know, doing this amazing work. But, you know, sometimes size and length is valuable in certain playoff matchups, and he's going to be at a disadvantage in those situations, even though you know you're going to get 100% effort from him. You know, it does put you in some less than ideal situations.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to Austin Flank asks, was Steph's buzzer beater right after the fight, the coolest thing anyone's done so far this season. I don't think we can say, I mean, Steph's buzzer beater was definitely the most demoralizing thing anyone's done this season, but I thought about it, and I don't think you can choose anybody but Dion Waiters hitting the three and crossing his arms after the game winner as the coolest moment of the season. Basically, everything Dion Waiters has done in Miami could qualify as an answer here.
I love that you use the word demoralizing, because I was thinking about that play from the Thunder's perspective, and it reminded me. So I used to like have this sort of job, or like, you know, responsibility of taking care of special needs kids after their school.
Uh-huh.
And I was playing this one kid chess, and I used to love playing chess. Like, I play a lot of speed chess online. Sorry, I'm indicting myself as a nerd here. I understand.
Dude,
anyway, I was playing the special needs.
Nothing is ever going to be nerdier than the Ben Agrino, first of all. But
all right.
Just
all right. This is the All Bets Are Off podcast. So anyway, I was playing chess with this special needs kid. He would like to talk a lot of trash. Like, he was sort of the LeVar Ball of this classroom.
Uh-huh.
And like, I was not going to take it easy on him, right? But he like beat me straight up, just beat me in chess, like seven moves, just like uh-huh. lights out, just like dominated me in chess. And he was just telling me all about it. And that's sort of what I imagine it felt like to be Russell Westbrook and Christian after that sort of Steph Curry. You know, they had this big blow up and Steph just answers it in like 6 seconds, you know, and what are you going to do? You know, the game's over at that exact moment. You've lost. It's checkmate. And now you have to hear about it from a team that will always tell you about it, whether it's Draymond or Steph and everybody else in that squad. So I felt bad for Oklahoma City. And from that standpoint, you know, it was one of the cooler things anybody's done.
Yeah, it must have been a rough, rough halftime for OKC. I don't think we talked about how miserable that halftime must have been.
See, if you're Billy Donovan, where you don't even say anything, you know, it's just like, we're good. Like, we'll just come back the next night.
I like how you just didn't even acknowledge my Waiters interlude there. That's fine. You keep sleeping on the Heat, man. We'll see what happens. Although we did jinx Dion Waiters into a sprained ankle over the weekend. So hopefully he recovers soon. Next question. Andrew says, best Larry Bird cameo, Blue Chips, Space Jam, or Celtic Pride? Have you seen those movies?
Yes, I have. It's been a while on some of them. I'm going with Space Jam, though, because it's the golf course. Bill Murray's involved. It's just kind of goofy. I mean, I think that's my answer. I don't know about you.
Space Jam, it was good to have him in Space Jam, but I feel like Space Jam has so many different, like, big, big name cameos that it's almost like Larry Bird's kind of just a throw in there. I went with Blue Chips because you can't beat the parade through French Lick in Blue Chips. And he had more lines in Blue Chips. Like, he was a kind of a main character. I mean, not a main character, but he had like a solid scene to himself in Blue Chips.
Can I tell you something else? This is just going to be the podcast of confessions. Okay. You know where my parents went on their honeymoon?
Please don't say to French Lick, Indiana.
French Lick, Indiana.
Why? Is your dad like a Larry Bird fanatic?
No, he actually went to Michigan State at the same time Magic was there, but I just think it was like the coolest thing that they could afford, which, you know, that's tough.
Okay.
Tough break. But yeah, that's my, the entirety of my connection with French Lick, Indiana is the worst honeymoon in American history.
That's great. Well, yes, I'm going with Blue Chips, and I've never been to French Lick. Have you?
No, I haven't. My brother went to college not too far from there. There's not much out there. So it's amazing what Larry Bird was able to do. The story of Larry Bird, by the way, like, you know, not wanting to be in college, doesn't fit in here, goes back home. He's, you know, considering a completely different career. It's one of the more underrated, like, origin stories of an NBA superstar. You know, people forget about it.
Can I also, another underrated Larry Bird story? We've gone so off the rails on this pod, but another underrated Bird story. Did you ever read about the time that he got into a fight in the middle of a playoff series against the Sixers? It was like a bar brawl, and he screwed up his hand. And there, the details were always kind of sketchy. Somebody was settled with out of court. And like, do you know anything about this?
No, I don't, but it's bringing to mind the idea of like Charles Barkley throwing someone through a glass window and having somebody get that on their Snapchat in this day and age. Imagine if that just broke, like Larry Bird was just in the middle of the playoffs in 2017 doing this.
Yeah, it's completely incredible that this all happened and there was no like suspension. It was just sort of like a story in the Globe, and then it kind of came and went, and Larry Bird played through it, and that was that. I'm going to look it up. It was an old article that was reposted on a Blogspot, and the details are pretty great. So,
one last thing about Larry Bird, though, is like, imagine if he had played at his full capacity until he was in his late 30s, like so many of these guys can today. You know, like,
yeah,
he is near the top of the list. Like, I'm not really a Larry Bird stan. Like, I know he's got a lot of cult fans out there. I'm not necessarily one of them, but he is one of those all time what ifs. Like, if he had just come along 15 years later when, you know, health and advancements had kind of come further and guys are taking better care of themselves, you know, maybe he's remembered on an even higher plane than he is currently in terms of the all time greats, you know?
Yeah. And they're also, a lot of times you'll hear people say Larry Bird would get his ass kicked if he were playing today, but
no,
I really don't think that's true. I think like
he
was at just as much of an athletic disadvantage in the 80s as he would be today, and he still figured out a way. Like, he was just so good. My favorite stories are the guys who will talk about being guarded by Bird and him telling them exactly how he was going to score and then hitting it.
Yeah, he would have been amazing in the Twitter age because he also wouldn't have cared. You know, he would have just kept doing what he did and just say, screw it, whatever people say they can say. So too bad we don't have a time machine for Larry Bird.
Yeah, one more. I read a book on the Celtics, like 91 Celtics toward the end. And Larry Bird, when he was rehabbing from an injury at one point, it was actually by former Sports Illustrated great Jack McCollum. But when he was rehabbing from an injury, he was like bored and would order entire wedding cakes and just eat the wedding cakes, like just sit there and eat entire wedding cakes. Basically, his reasoning was nobody will ever screw up a wedding cake. So he was getting like the best possible cakes. And that was what he did for an entire offseason at one point.
This is like bringing back the Dwight Howard sidebar of the peanut butter and jelly story.
That's great
definitely
point.
A Dwight Howard move.
That's a great point. Yeah. Okay. So next question, Steve, after hearing your latest chat about D Wade potentially heading back to Miami after this year to go to a contender, it got me thinking. There was also that Nuggets offer on the table in free agency. Obviously the Bulls didn't work out, but would either the Nuggets or Heat have been better this year if Wade was there? Or does he stifle the Jokic growth or the sun shining on Waiters Island? Which of the three Wade decision timelines would you most want to live in? For me, I kind of like what a disaster this Bulls season has been. It's been sort of a, no matter what, whenever you want to feel better about the team that you like, you can go look at the Bulls and could be worse. Could be worse. And I would not want Wade back on the Heat because I would worry about him and Dragic, actually. Not him and Waiters, but I don't think it would have been as fun this year. And the Wade in Denver scenario just never really made that much sense to me.
Yeah, so I hate it when you make good points, but you made a bunch of good points there. I mean, Miami works because they're sort of like the South Beach Skyforce, like D-League squad, plus Dragic, and Hassan Whiteside too. But Wade screws up everything that makes them go in terms of like the crazy, plucky, overachieving nature to their success. That's all out the window. In terms of Denver, not only does it kind of get in the way of Jokic being like, you know, one of the best facilitators in the entire league and, you know, kind of turning over the whole franchise in his image, but it also probably holds Gary Harris back a little bit. Gary Harris has been a pretty nice find for them. So that's going to be an issue there. And it also just kind of compounds their issue of like, how much are they going to play their young guys versus their old guys? Like, are you super excited about chasing the 8th seed when you're starting backwards Jameer Nelson and Dwayne Wade? Like, give me a break. That's rough. So from that standpoint, yeah, I think by process of elimination, we might as well screw the Bulls up. I mean, I feel really bad for Jimmy Butler throughout all of this. I mean, his career has never looked weirder in terms of like what direction is it going, especially if Wade opts out.
Yeah.
You know, at the same time, though, as long as they can take care of Waiters, Is there room for a Wade comeback if he comes back in a smaller role? Like if they just make it clear, like, hey, you're the guy coming off the bench here.
I know you want to believe in that, and I want you to be out in front on the Wade back to Miami theory. I don't know. Because I really do think like they've figured something out with Dragic. I feel like the relationship with Riley is like all that drama was pretty real. And I don't think Wade would want to go back there.
This is going to be tails between his leg, Wade, though, right? Like he's going to have to kind of come back hat in hand saying, okay, I'm willing to accept any role. You know, I'm not the same guy. Because if he doesn't go back to Miami, like if they don't welcome him back, and I feel like they probably would be shameless enough to welcome him back. I mean, he's going to sell a lot of tickets. They're going to get a lot of positive buzz off that. Where does he go? Like, you know, it's almost like one of these Rose situations where it's just like, who is going to take him, you know?
Yeah, I think you're overrating how humble Wade is after this Bulls season, because there are a lot of other people in Chicago that you can blame. But we'll see. I mean, because, yeah, I can't think of anywhere else where he would make sense at like $15 million a year. So in that respect, yeah, maybe Miami's the only option. I still think he's going to opt in and just get paid and force the Bulls to make a move. But
that is like the most depressing. I mean, that's more depressing than any of the three scenarios that were outlined in the question. It's like Wade going back to Chicago to do it again. Ugh.
Yeah, yeah. It's been a rough coda to Dwayne Wade's career, but it's all good. He's a Hall of Famer regardless.
Hey, we got a question from Braden. He wants to know, Markelle Fultz, you know, projected number one pick, Markelle Fultz, the future of the Celtics potentially. Is he just Damon Stoudemire in a bigger body?
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought about Damon Stoudemire until I saw this question. And if Damon Stoudemire were 6 inches taller, because he was like 5'10", right?
Mighty Mouse. Yeah, it's kind of hard to imagine like Mighty Mouse in a normal size body. Like it doesn't quite work, right?
Yeah, and I think mentioning Damon Stoudemire in the same sentence as Markelle Fultz is a little bit underwhelming for people. And it's not the right comparison. But shout out to Damon Stoudemire. Hadn't thought about you in about 5 years. Fultz should be pretty awesome. He's from DC and Seattle, so he really checks all the boxes for me. But in case anyone thinks I'm biased, like at All-Star Weekend, for example, I was just trying to gauge the skepticism. So I asked the scouting friend whether Fultz was really that good, and he kind of laughed at me, and then he pulled out his phone and made me watch these grainy videos that he had taken of his TV with different Fultz highlights. So basically, like, Fultz has NBA people standing out in their living rooms taking personal vines. Like, he's that level of dude. I think if you're trying to compare him to somebody, maybe Harden, except, like, he's explosive, like, Wall. I don't know. Well,
Hold on one second. Let me stop you right there, because I'm going to surprise you.
Okay.
Not only did I watch a bunch of tape on Fultz in preparation for today's conversation, which I know is mind-blowing, I also read up on his comps. So he is getting this insane range of comps. Here's some of the people I saw him get comp to. Harden, John Wall, Damian Lillard, D'Angelo Russell, Dwayne Wade, and Bradley Beal. And then our questioner threw in Damon Stoudemire, which...
Yeah, Stoudemire is way off the reservation.
So that's like, first of all, that's two different positions worth of players, which is you know, kind of an interesting scenario. The one thing I do see with Damon, Stoudemire, and Fultz is the stop and pop ability. Like Fultz,
yes.
he's pulling, you know, he's gunning. And there's a little bit of slitheriness to his game as well off the dribble, which I think that's probably why he's getting Wade and maybe even Wall comps, like whether they're in transition. And I guess Harden too, really, whether they're in transition or even in the half court, like when they're going downhill, there's lots of Euro stepping and just kind of like sliding by slower defenders. That kind of brings to mind some of those guys. The Beal comp to me, though, don't you think he's a little bit more aggressive off the dribble than Beal is? And I know Beal's kind of made progress on that this year in terms of getting the foul line more and trying to be a little bit more assertive. But Fultz to me is kind of a different breed of creator off the dribble.
Oh, 100%. The Beal thing is out of left field. I don't know. I mean, Fultz is not that type of shooter, first of all. Like, his form is solid, and you can see, you can envision him turning into a good shooter, but he's probably not there now. I really like the Harden Wade parallels. Like, what's most impressive about Fultz is that he's really explosive, but he's already so under control, like the way he moves. And I think that you were sort of alluding to that with some of the stop and pop. Like, he can freeze in traffic and elevate and get any look he wants.
Yeah, I'd say too, like, I mean, I don't know. I guess his shooting numbers are pretty good from outside. That guy is confident pulling up off the dribble, you know? And so Maybe that's where the Lillard part of the comp comes in. Some people have thrown out of just like, he is not afraid to just, you know, take a shot from 30 feet or 28 feet. I mean, you know, he's not knocking him down like Steph Curry, but in that way, he's very different from a guy like Dwayne Wade, who you would just never see do that, you know, earlier in his career.
I just like that he's sort of an urban legend while everybody watches March Madness. And it's also pretty funny when, like, you'll see people hype up various players who have been playing this month, like Jason Tatum and Lonzo Ball, and you'll see them write, like, he's potential number one pick, like, could go, but Fultz is so clearly the number one pick. Everyone needs to just agree that, like, we don't have to lie to hype up Lonzo Ball is still really good, but he's not going to be the number one pick, and neither is Jason Tatum. And all of which is to say that will be a really funny soundbite when the Lakers get number one and demand to take and take Lonzo Ball anyways.
Hey, here's a question for you. I got to thinking about some of these teams that are in rebuild mode this year, and you know, I was thinking about the Sixers. I think we're at the point now where a guy like Ben Simmons is the single most under-discussed impact player in the NBA. I mean, he hasn't been in a competitive game, if you don't count Summer League, for more than a year at this point. By the time next season rolls around, it's going to be 18 months. I mean, that's a super long time to be off the radar, and I think it really lends itself, that absence does, to just forgetting about what he can do. I mean, if you had to guess Rookie of the Year next year, whether it's Simmons, Fultz, Ball, or somebody else, I mean, should we be viewing Simmons as the favorite?
That's a great point. I hadn't thought about him being included in that rookie class. Man, I don't know. I mean,
because, you know, I kind of like Simmons, you know, like, I've kind of been on his team.
You have. I feel like you really have.
This is the time to buy Ben Simmons stock, right?
Yeah. I mean, certainly it's at an all-time low. People don't even really factor him in when they talk about the Sixers. I think one of the things that's going to be really interesting with them is that Simmons plays a pretty similar position to Saric. And I'm not sure how they're going to sort of navigate that. I really want the Sixers to get a solid guard from this draft. I think everybody's sort of on the same page that we can't draft any more big men. But if they can get a shooter to pair with Simmons, like, that team could get really, really fun real quick.
Yeah, one reason why I kind of like Simmons over a guy like Fultz, at least in the short term, is I think strength-wise, he's going to be able to more naturally break down defenses and get into the paint more than Fultz. I'm a little bit worried about Fultz kind of falling into the same camp as a guy like Russell, where a lot of stuff going to the basket happens in college, and like, Fultz is just like slicing up Yale, you know, like on these highlight clips.
Yeah, that's a fair
it's
point.
Like, you know, Yale is not the same thing as the Warriors or the Spurs or whoever else, right? And so I'm worried that his offense is going to start to be a little bit more jumper dependent, a little bit more settling once he gets to the pro level, because maybe he's not going to be able to draw the same level of contact. He's not going to be able to get as many easy baskets going to the rim. Whereas I think a guy like Simmons, even though we know he's a little bit afraid to shoot, well, not even a little bit, a lot afraid to shoot, I think just his physicality will allow him to get deeper penetration than maybe Fultz or Russell have to date. And that's going to put a lot of pressure on his teammates to knock down open shots, like you're saying. But I think you're going to get a little bit more of that from a guy like Simmons just based on his sheer size.
Yeah, it's a good point. If you're actually, we don't need to handicap next year's Rookie of the Year race now, but I do think that you're right. Like, guards in general, just the learning curve is steeper and it's like D'Angelo Russell is going to take a few years. John Wall took a few years, like, and all these perimeter guys will probably take a year or two. Although I did talk to a scout today who was like, put Lonzo Ball in the NBA next year and he will find a way to get you like 12-7, which is solid. But I think big picture, we're going to need to be patient with a bunch of these guys. However, I will say that also big picture, we started the pod talking about how all of the best young players are big men. And now this draft is going to provide some of the perimeter guys that will kind of shape the next 10 years or so.
For sure. And I think that's when you're talking about Fultz, the comp that comes, you know, with Harden is just that he has an incredibly high ceiling as a spread pick and roll lead option.
Yeah,
you know, his fill already is really, really good. Surround him with talented players, the right type of finishers, the right kind of shooters. And it's very easy to see Fultz leading a top three offense not that far into the distant future. Now, yes, it's probably going to take 3 years, 4 years. But by the end of his rookie contract, like, the ceiling is definitely there to be just this monster where there's not really a good answer for him because he can score in all the best ways.
Yo, I'm so proud of you for watching some Fultz footage and diving into the draft waters with me. I really appreciate it.
I'm here. I'm ready to do it. Well, all it took was one reference to Damon Stoudemire. And then it was like, oh, let's fact check this. Okay.
All right. So one more draft question here. Ed from London asks, was looking at the Tankathon, which one would you prefer to be? Sacramento with potentially picks 7, 8, and 35. Orlando with picks 4, 23, 32, and 34. Or Boston with 1, 39, 53-57. What do you think?
I hate to take the easy answer, but I think I would just take the best overall pick. And yeah, maybe some of it is like the scars of the McDermott trade from the Bulls, where like they're trying to get too cute, like packaging picks together to get their guy. But I feel like that strategy has backfire potential. One thing about the Kings, though, they need to nail both of their picks. Like, the more I've been looking at their future, like, this draft is so important for them. Number one, they're totally screwed if New Orleans somehow jumps into the top three, so they lose that pick because they have so little talent and so many holes. I mean, you can make argument that they have holes at the one, the two, the three, and the four. And if you don't like Cauley Stein, you can make an argument they have a hole at the five too.
Yeah. So holes everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, it's just Swiss cheese, their entire roster. So they need as many young prospects to get in the building as possible. And two top 10 picks would go a long way towards kind of brightening their future. You know, that being said, can they even get those guys to go there to work out? Open question. That's going to be kind of tricky. But I think if I had to choose between one of those three teams, I'd just choose Boston because, yeah, you know, Fultz, like, they've been able to put Jaylen Brown in a position to succeed this year. You know, like, throwing at him increasing amounts of responsibility and seeing how much he can do. Like, if you take a player like Fultz, who definitely has a higher ceiling, especially as an offensive player, and you give him that same sort of like Celtics U approach where it's like, yeah, we're just going to slowly work you in and just keep working you in more and more instead of throwing him to the Wolves. You know, that to me is a better scenario than either one of these other rebuilding outfits.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, Sacramento, if I were the Kings specifically, though, I would rather have two lottery picks in this top 10,
yeah,
as opposed to having the number one pick. Because I think, like you said, they just need guys. They need like dependable players that they can build around. And this draft is not quite as amazing. Like, I think the rhetoric has sort of gotten a little out of control with the top 10, but like there are definitely got like all sorts of guys you would be excited to take in those first 10 picks. And then it drops off a little bit, but this is a good draft to have two top 10 picks.
Hey, one more draft question we got from Leon. I don't know if that's a name or a place, but maybe it's both. Leon wants to know, is this draft class somewhat overrated? And he says he's a Celtics fan, but he's having trouble getting excited by these top guys. And we just mentioned every possible reason why you should get excited about Fultz. So let's just assume we didn't convince him about that. He says that the internet has really hyped up these Nets picks as treasured assets. He's just not sure he sees what the fuss is all about. are there any guys who are just sort of guaranteed can't miss prospects at the top of this draft, or is this just the annual hype cycle kind of catching up? I mean, this is a pretty hyped draft class. And like I said, I'd probably take Ben Simmons over anyone in this class, at least in the short term. Are you willing to defend this class as being, you know, pretty good at the top?
I am. I've had that thought. I've definitely had the everyone is getting is just sort of losing their mind here, because somewhere along the line, like talking about how good this draft class was became a way to signal that you're like clued in and you're a smarter basketball fan. And I do think it's a really good class. But a lot of these guys have question marks and we just have no idea how it'll pan out. I think like you go back, like the 2015 draft, for instance, was really deep in the lottery. You had Cat, you had Porzingis, D'Angelo Russell, I still think will be very good. Devin Booker, Miles Turner. I'm still a Justice Winslow believer. And so like, I think that's as good of a draft class as you can expect from this. Like, I think you're talking about a couple franchise players and a couple all-stars. So next to the hype that people have created around this draft, I think people would be disappointed if that was all we got out of it. So I don't know. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, it does. I think there's also a LeVar Ball skewing effect going on. I mean, because there's just been so much noise that's probably going to turn, you know, a good chunk of people off of just like, oh, this is too much. But I think I just want to take a philosophical defense of hyping the draft in general, because look, the Lakers have shut down half their team. The Suns have shut down half their team. The Kings traded half their team. Orlando never really had a team in the first place. The Sixers have had multiple gruesome injuries, and the Knicks are the Knicks, right? That's basically a quarter of the league that has nothing going for it. So like, if you're not able to get hyped up and excited about this draft, that's a problem. You know, if you're one of those fans, I mean, then you're just not paying attention at all to the NBA. So I say bring on the draft hype, because, you know, if you're not selling wins, you're selling hope. All these guys represent hope. And there's a lot of teams out there that have been in just complete shutdown mode here already, even though there's almost a month left in the regular season. So whether or not this is like an A-plus draft or an A-minus draft or a B draft, whatever you want to call it, I'm not sure that that matters, because there's so many desperate teams out there that it better be good.
Yeah, I just think that people need to sort of like, it's a really good draft, but a really good draft still only has two or maybe three like franchise players in it. That's my only point, is that like, I understand why someone might call it overrated, because sometimes the way people are talking is like, yeah, you're like, you just said, all these teams are throwing away their seasons and almost all of them are not going to get like a savior. Like, I think Fultz is really the only guy who is definitely like a cornerstone type player.
So our answer to this guy who said he was a Celtics fan is that he should be hyped up, because they're going to get Fultz and it's going to be unfair.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's like, dude, like, be happy with these treasured assets. Come on.
Our answer is that it is properly rated and overrated and maybe even underrated. All right. So we should probably move on and call it a pod here. Do you have any final question?
Well, there was a couple quick ones. I think we need to shout out Sean Drought. He had a funny commentary here with this question. He says, given the Kobe contract was one of the things that helped tank the Lakers, does that make Rob Pelinka, who was Kobe's GM, who negotiated that contract, does that make him the Frank Underwood of the NBA? In other words, did he intentionally sink the Lakers to the point where they would get so desperate that they would hire him to save them? I mean, that is kind of like a next level chess move, if that is really what happened.
I love Kobe sort of looming in the shadows of whatever's going on with the Lakers. Like, I don't know how he's going to make a move and how he's going to be involved, but I'm really glad that we are going to have the next few years to speculate like where Kobe's fingerprints are on the Lakers rebuild.
For sure. I love that theory. Let's just give it to him. Let's just say Rob Pelinka did that, because that's a great way to kind of build up the Lakers' future hopes, knowing that they have someone so intelligent and devious running their future. Hey, last question here from D. Barton. He wanted to know, in terms of March Madness teams, who's the all Golliver team and who's the all Sharp team in terms of which program best represents the caricatures we've made of ourselves here in the NBA? Did you have an answer to that one?
Mine is clearly the Kentucky Wildcats, who have been... Have you watched any of Kentucky?
A little bit. I mean, oozing with bucket getters, right? And talent?
Yeah, kind of. Like, they're definitely oozing with bucket getters, but they have no idea how to run an offense. Like, in parts of both games, I've seen them just like... They just kind of swing it until someone freaks out and shoots. Like, basically, if Malik Monk is not, like, cooking, they really have no options because they need to throw it inside, but they don't have big guys to help sort of, like, anchor the offense. So they're very guardable, and yet they might go to the Elite Eight. I'm so excited for the UCLA-Kentucky game. All Golliver, like, it's got to be UVA, right?
I was going to say, isn't it maybe Michigan State? Like, I don't really know enough about this, but, like, isn't, like, hard work, overachieving every year, Izzo? Like, isn't there a lot of, like, Golliver tendencies there?
I mean, yes, there's definitely... Michigan State might be a little bit too watchable, though. Definitely the Hawks of college basketball are the Virginia Cavaliers. One of the reasons I love Brogdon so much in Milwaukee is because I can enjoy his game without having to watch the awful UVA offense score like 50 points a game. And I think, did UVA make the Sweet 16?
Yeah, you're asking the wrong guy there, but I tried. Look, I watched Fultz tape. Like, how much do you want from me here?
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Well, on that note, let's call it a night. I will talk to you soon. Oh, no. UVA scored 39 points in the second round. So UVA did not make the Sweet 16. They lost to Florida. But I can't wait for UCLA-Kentucky Friday night. It should be fun. Sunday, we have the Rockets and the Thunder. A lot to look forward to this weekend.
This was an all-time classic podcast. I mean, I'm not sure what else people want from us. We had peanut butter tacos. We had losing chess to special needs students. We had you giving us an incredibly detailed breakdown on Markel Fultz and the draft class.
Look,
you know what?
My brain has really not been working for about the last 45 minutes. So I appreciate anyone who stuck with us.
And if you enjoyed this, you know what to do. 5 stars reviews on iTunes only. Also check out Rob Mahoney's Breakaway podcast. Andrew, until next week.
All right, man. Take it easy.
Whoa. This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.